Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Alana Makover, who is an Alexander Technique teacher in London, England. She's been a teacher for over 25 years. She's also a childbirth educator and a doula, and she teaches Utokia classes, which are based on the Alexander Technique, the preparing women for childbirth. In a previous podcast, we've talked a lot about how the Alexander Technique can be very helpful to women who are pregnant. And in this interview, we're going to talk primarily about the childbirth process itself. Alana, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Alana, could you once again just give our listeners a very short description or definition, if you like, of the Alexander Technique so they have some idea what we're talking about here?
Well, one of the first thing I say to people about the Alexander Technique that it is a self-help method that we teach them to use themselves in activity, which I mean move, because this is what we sort of do most of the time, in a way that will not interfere with our design, in the way that we understand this design. And that actually there is now more and more scientific proof that Alexander understood the design very well. And it is quite interesting to think about his journey sometimes. It's so intriguing how he discovered what he discovered with so little knowledge about anatomy and physiology and neurology and all the things that we know today.
Well, he was a self-taught man living in an obscure corner of the English and British Empire in the late 19th century.
It is something.
It's pretty. It is a pretty amazing story.
Pretty amazing story, definitely. And he discovered that he himself, through his own observation, after a short while, actually, he discovered that he interfered with the head-neck-back relationship, like a sort of a good engineer that looks at the bridge and can tell if it's good or not. He looked at himself when he was still and when he was active, and he noticed that he was doing something that was not right. And that was the interference with what he called, he coined it eventually, the primary control, which is the relationship between the head and the neck and the back, which allows the head to find its balance on the top of the spine without any, necessity to hold it or to let it flop.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people will be surprised to learn just how much their heads weigh. Typically 10 to 12 pounds, which in America equates to a bowling ball or 3-4 pound sacks of sugar or flour, which is pretty heavy. And there it is poised up at the top of our spine, or perhaps not poised, perhaps held in place in some way. And of course, Alexander teachers see a huge value in encouraging a natural poise of the head, because it requires less work and sets the stage for all sorts of good things throughout the rest of the body. Do you agree with that? I mean, I will agree with it.
I would like to add to it that in the previous talk, we talked about the wish of the pelvis, of the uterus to come forward and up as the baby grows in us. Mm-hmm. I would like also to say that the back has a wish. It is to lengthen rather than to shorten, to have more space between the vertebras than less, and that by releasing any unnecessary tension in the head, there is a possibility at that time to allow the back his wish to lengthen.
I think that's a really important point, that is what our spines want to do. They want to lengthen.
See it as an inner wish.
Well, it's part of our design.
Yes.
And most small kids, small children, do a pretty decent job of not interfering with that unless there's some particular circumstance they're in. But pretty quickly, we learn how to mess that up. And I guess you could say the Alexander technique is, a lot of it is about learning how to let go of that messing up that we have, those habits we've acquired that get in the way.
I would like to add something here that I think gives hope to people that we can restore it. Because sometimes people are frustrated. You know, as babies and toddlers, we cannot learn to move unless we have the primary control,
which is
total balance of the head on the top
exactly.
of the spine.
Yeah.
We cannot learn to sit up, to stand, to walk unless we have it. Of course, it is on a subconscious level. Babies do not know what they have, but they cannot learn it otherwise. The ability of a newborn baby to balance its big head, and babies' heads are bigger than the rest of their body in proportion. It's amazing how these little creatures can balance their head on the top of the spine very early on.
Absolutely.
We are looking at when a child is born, after a few days, we say, oh, isn't it wonderful? It can hold its head. Well, it doesn't hold it at all. It balances it.
Holding it would be quite a job for a baby.
Yeah, quite. And then I say to them, they can't hold it. They balance it. Isn't it wonderful? And I think that throughout, let's say, the first 2-3 years of our life, we are in total balance of the head on the top of the spine, and we start to interfere later on in our lives. We won't go into why, because this is really an enormous issue for which you need probably 5 other podcasts. But to just come back to this idea that we all had it, we were all there, is, I think, whatever we had, we can gain back again if we want.
Well, I think without our having had that at some point, it's really hard for me to imagine how Alexander lessons could get very far, because really we're in the business of helping people get out of the way. And, unless they've already had some experience somewhere in their lifetime, I don't think we could do all that much for them. Now, you might disagree with that. That's just my thought on the subject.
No, I don't disagree, actually. I just think that by pointing it out
to people, absolutely, yes.
I give them, I show them that, that makes sense.
Right.
Had it once. So I can get it back.
Absolutely. And in our previous podcast, we talked a lot about how you would work with women who are pregnant to help them restore that. And also we talked a lot about the balance issues that face pregnant women with the change in weight distribution. We talked a lot about allowing the uterus to rise, as you said, forward and up. the way it's designed to. And towards the end of our conversation, you mentioned a couple of specific things that you do with pregnant women that maybe wouldn't feature quite as prominently with in an ordinary Alexander lesson, in particular having women go into a modified standing position that Alexander teachers like to call a monkey, which is knees bent forward and the torso bent forward from the hips, and then also going on all fours. And you made the point, and maybe you could just reiterate that here before we get into childbirth itself, that apart from the beneficial effects those have on the pregnant woman, they also encourage, I'm a little careful about my terminology here, but they encourage the baby to be in an optimal position, I think you said, for birth. Is that correct? And maybe you could just elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, it's to settle. Mm-hmm. It has to settle in this optimal position.
Right.
Now, the optimal position for birth is that when the head is down and the back of the baby is more towards the left side of the woman and its leg, it's kicking towards the liver.
Mm-hmm.
If baby, because we are not symmetrical inside,
right,
if the baby settles, start to move more towards the right side, it will not be with its back towards the abdominal wall, but it will be with its back more towards the spine.
Uh-huh.
So because the liver is a very big organ, you see, where the stomach is a small one, and the liver is on the right and the stomach is on the left.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
If it settles on the wrong side, more with the back towards the back rather than the back towards the abdominal wall, it will have to do a very, very big turn in order to be born, all the way to roll all from the back to bring itself with its back towards the abdominal wall so that the head can be born in the way that it is designed to be born, where the smallest circumference of the head faces the cervix and the birth canal.
Mm-hmm. And that in turn is made more likely, it's more likely that the baby will settle where it's designed to settle if a woman spends some time on all fours. Is that basically what you're saying? Or is there a bit more to it than that?
There's just a little bit more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
Modern furniture, and since we have television apparently, are designed so that we are all the time tilting back, resting in sofas.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see the position in which we take when we sit down to watch television?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Leaning.
Yeah.
Well, you see, when we lean back, we push the contents of the pelvis up, and the baby find it's somehow, it's a little bit confused, really. And it is not encouraged to settle in the right position.
Mm-hmm.
And women now spend many hours watching television or tilting back in other ways. For instance, long driving, which women didn't do before the Second World War, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend more and more time leaning back and pushing the contents of the whole pelvis up, which confuses the baby. And we know from records that midwives hold that there is a big increase in what we call malposition for birth.
Mm-hmm.
since television, since the end of the Second World War.
Well, that's interesting. And as you said before, malposition just makes the whole process a lot trickier and a lot iffier, and I assume increases the chances of the necessity of a cesarean or something like that. Is that, would that be fair to say?
It is indeed. Yeah. It is. It makes labor longer, more painful, and much more likely to interfere with drugs. And then drugs will bring about, it's a chain. It's, no, women think it's only, it will alleviate the pain. It doesn't work like that. It's 50% of women who take drug end up with either forceps or cesarean.
Right, right.
So it's, well, it's food for thought,
right,
isn't it?
It certainly is. And in America, I don't know what the trends are in England, but in America, the percentage of births that are done with cesarean have increased dramatically in recent years, to the point where it's almost become, I wouldn't say the standard way, but pretty common. And this is a field I don't know a lot about, but I don't remember as a kid ever hearing the term cesarean, so I have a feeling that's a fairly recent development.
Well, it is, you know, not recent in the sense, historically it's recent, but
yeah,
in our lifetime.
Right, right, right.
It's been going on the increase, you know, again, since the Second World War, actually. But the increase all the time, and it's the same in England.
Yeah.
It's on the increase. It's not as terrible as in America, really, where it reaches about, I think, 40% by now.
I think now it's closer to 50. I just read an article in the Times. This is a huge shift, I think, over the last decade or so. And there are all kinds of reasons for it. Some of them are economic, having to do with how doctors are compensated. But that's a whole other podcast.
That's another issue, really.
Right, right.
But it is on the increase. If you want to avoid it, because we are not designed to have this, you know, knife cutting into it every time we want to have a child.
Right.
You have to really prepare yourself very well. Otherwise, you're very likely to end up with a cesarean.
Well, and, you know, we've talked a lot about how you work with women who are pregnant and women who are getting close to childbirth. What changes in the way you work with women when they get really close to childbirth and maybe are in childbirth? How do you use the Alexander technique at that point?
Well, I teach them, first of all, a basic movement that I call the pear movement, which I'll try to describe it to you. It's when a woman is on all four, and on the onset of a contraction, which is a strong way in which the uterus contracts in order to efface the cervix, she starts to move, and imagining that if she's holding a pencil in her mouth, she will draw a shape of a pear, which is a nice shape because also the uterus is the shape of a pear, on the floor. And as she will be moving and creating this shape with her body, she will have all her joints free. She will create saliva to calm down. She will breathe out through her mouth. It is not exactly the time to whisper ah in the way that we teach it, although I teach it when I teach very proper, because it's all about breathing through the mouth and not gasping for air and not stop breathing.
And
because
just,
the pain
just, sorry,
does it for
could
us.
We just pause here for just a second to explain whispered ah? That, do you want to define that or explain what that is?
Whisper ah is, I think, one of the exercises that Alexander developed in order to prove to people or to show them that there is no need to gasp for air.
Right, right.
That as they stop the breath out, the air will just come in and there is no need to take it. So it's not like I'm talking to you and I'm talking to you and I'm, you know, gasping for air every time, you know, after I expel some out.
Right.
But
right.
I just let it come in. And I think both of us, as we are talking, I'd never heard you gasping for air.
Well, you know, all those years of being an Alexander teacher, it would be a little shocking maybe if I were.
Yeah, and I
think there might be the occasional snort there, but
And yeah. I hope that I came across as not as someone.
Right, right.
Who gasps for air. But anyway, I teach them to just think about the breath out and trust that the air will come in. And as we work on this movement, it's got many aspects. It is both physically soothing because you are moving. I wouldn't like to use the word relaxed, but with ease. You are not locking your joint, because if you lock your joint, you won't be able to create really a nice pair. Yeah, it will be somehow with sharp
edges
somewhere. And also mentally, you are engaged with a movement. You cannot think about anything else except this movement. So you're not end gaining. You are just going, sailing, flowing with the pain.
So when you say not end gaining, again, that's a bit of Alexander terminology. And basically, I'm gathering that you're saying you're not trying to get the birth over with. You're focusing on your breathing and drawing this outline, and you're in a sense allowing what needs to happen for the birth to happen.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a hard thing for people to do, because and I would think especially in that situation, and especially if labor has gone on for a while, the temptation would be pretty strong to try to do something to make it happen.
That's very true. That's very true. But, you know, there are also psychological changes during the birth process. If a woman is really left on her own to cope, when nobody creates unnecessary tension around her, not make silly remarks that upset her or try to suggest too many things, but just let her be there at the moment. There is time in labor, whereas the woman moves onto another planet. I think that Michel Audin described it very well in his book Birth Reborn, which I would recommend to anybody who is interested in childbirth without not even thinking about the Alexander technique.
Well, certainly, I mean, we know that in a lot of societies, sometimes I think incorrectly labeled primitive societies, women give birth without much of any to-do about it. I remember reading about, I believe it was in Uganda, where a woman will just, who's working in the field, will just oh, it's time for the baby, and we'll just go off, have the baby, and within a fairly short time be back working again, which
well,
is pretty remarkable, I think. And I think one woman was asked, well, how did you know it was time? And she said, well, how do I know when I'm hungry?
Yes.
Which that left quite an impression on me. I'm wondering, in terms of how you work with women in childbirth, as a doula, I assume then that you're present for the birth itself. Is that correct?
Yes.
And who else is present? Is there a nurse or a nurse practitioner, or how does that work in your situation?
In England, in England, according to the law, a mother has to have a midwife.
A midwife, okay.
Yes, she's not. You are not allowed to give birth on your own.
Mm-hmm.
You are not allowed to plan such a thing.
Well,
you
I
know?
Think that's true here as well. So, so there is someone who is, how could we put it, more the specialist in
a midwife.
Birthing, a midwife. And
midwife.
I assume that you must have established good relationships with midwives so that you can work as a team with the pregnant woman, with the woman who's giving birth. Is that fair to say?
Well, it will be a little bit exaggerated because the turnout of midwives is enormous. And I go to several, you know, sometimes hospitals or home birth. And then it depends. There are many midwives around. On the whole, they welcome a doula.
Mm-hmm.
Because a doula can be with the mother more than midwives nowadays can. And it is probably because of the nature of in which the profession has developed and in the demands on the midwives that they are not hands-on midwives as they used to be.
And so that's where you come in as the doula, but not just an ordinary doula, but a doula who has this Alexander technique background as well.
That's right.
And so I'm imagining that at various points, maybe you're using your hands or verbal directions to guide your student as the birthing process takes place?
Yes, I do. And also the partner. Often the partner is present.
Yeah, I bet the partner needs it more than the woman sometimes.
Yeah, well,
I can imagine that.
We work together.
Right.
We
right.
work together. The best compliment that I ever heard was at birth when the mother was offered an epidural. And she said, no, no, Ilana and my husband are my epidural. I don't need any.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah.
That was the best compliment I ever heard.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Said,
is there anything, before we come to a close on this podcast, is there anything we haven't mentioned that you especially would like to talk about before we come to an end?
Well, I just mentioned that there are various movements that a woman can perform during the whole process of labor. As long as she has to, after she's been having lessons with me, and if I am with her at birth, I would remind her about directions. About inhibition, I'm not using these words during labor. You don't talk too much. You are just there, and you go with. Mm-hmm. And maybe from time to time, you just suggest perhaps we haven't been going up and down a wall for a while, or we didn't squat for a while, or would you like to go and pee for for instance, things like that. But to be with a woman during the birth is perhaps another issue.
And, you know, I asked you a similar question to this in our last interview. Obviously, it would be ideal for a woman who wants a doula to have a doula who's also an Alexander teacher, but that's not going to be all that common. And we discussed the whole question of, is it useful for a woman who's pregnant to have Alexander lessons from just a plain old ordinary Alexander teacher? And agreed that it would be. And would you say the same thing in terms of the birth process itself, that even if you have a teacher who is not likely to be someone there at the birth, but could give you sort of general Alexander instructions beforehand while you're, you know, before the birthing time, is that, would you agree that that would be a useful thing to do?
Very much so, and I would recommend to everybody to have a doula. Regardless of her other credentials.
Oh, I would think so. I know a number of women who have done that and have found it made a huge difference in their experience. So if my guest today has been Alana Machover, who's an Alexander teacher in London, England, also a childbirth educator and a doula. And if anything we've talked about intrigues you and you live in the London area, contact Alana through her website. She has written a number of articles and books and on this general topic, and they're all you can find them all on her website. And if you live anywhere else in the world, we'll put a link to a website that will enable you to find a teacher wherever you are located. Alana, thank you so much for this podcast and the one before.
Thank you very much, Robert. It was a pleasure.